Excellent. Okay, Gabriella, it's over to you straight away. No messing about in any way, shape or form. What is the weather forecast for Lincoln, England, from, of course, your base in Gibraltar, as you see it?
Okay, so the weather for Lincoln today is highs of 8 degrees centigrade, lows of 0 degrees centigrade, and it's a day of heavy rain and fresh breezes. It's going to be a terrible day.
Yeah, well, and what's it like in Gibraltar?
We've got about 18 degrees today, cloudy, a bit of sunshine, and lows of 12, so yeah. It's not too bad. Actually, yesterday we had about 20 degrees. It's been unseasonably warm for February.
Well, you know, these things clearly happen, possibly as a result of global warming.
Live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
And happy World Radio Day, Gabriella, because that's the other day that we're celebrating today. I know. Very exciting. We'll be talking to Dr. Becky Spellman about World Radio Day and how things have changed over the years in some ways, and yet not. Meanwhile, whom would you like to speak to? You've obviously got Ice Magician David Fox. You've got the wonderful Jessica, who, of course, you spoke to last week when we had Lord Victor in the house, the Chancellor at the University of Lincoln.
Yeah.
We work with that. And we've got, of course, making her debut on the whole production, the wonderful Eleanor Dean. Who do you want to go to, Gabriella?
How about Eleanor?
Yeah.
Hello.
You know, first time, and did you do yesterday, the afternoon one?
No.
This is the very first one. Yeah,
we threw her into the morning show straight away before the evening slot even started.
Oh, my God. So, how are you finding it, and why journalism?
So, originally, I was not going to university at all. I was actually going to go into the RAF. And unfortunately, I failed the medical due to asthma. And then I had about 2 weeks to decide what I wanted to do. Journalism was always another option for me. I'm always kind of drawn to the news. I enjoy finding out what's going on in the world, and I enjoy listening to people's stories and telling them. So it seemed like a sensible option for me to do, and something that I'd really enjoy. And having that enjoyment there was really important for me. So, yeah, I'm obviously now a first year University of Lincoln student doing journalism, and I'm loving it. I'm loving the politics. Weirdly enough, I enjoyed law. I didn't think I would, and I am. And the production side of things as well, going out interviewing people and editing my own thing is something that I love the practical side and getting out there and, you know, sinking my teeth into things. So.
And it's fair to say, Eleanor, that it may well be we can reconnect you with aspects of the RAF, such as the Red Arrows, if you stick with the programme various other bits and pieces.
So, yeah, that would be very exciting.
I think so. Can you remember, Gabriella, your first shows on the Midweek Drive, you know, when you were also a Level 1 journalist student, and then we went through the whole process?
I was in third year.
Were you in third year before you actually started the Midweek Drive? Good heavens.
Yeah.
Well, there we are.
I only did it for 1 year.
Yeah.
I don't remember it.
Yeah. Mind you, I think
I remember loads of shows, but I can't pinpoint which one was the
specific one. Obviously, not a Red Letter Day, but never mind. Obviously, from your own point
of view, I remember a lot of them.
Yeah, it's quite about what's not. Gabriella, the other thing that Eleanor is actually undergoing, of course, is she's having to go through the sheer trauma, almost like Vietnam-like trauma, of what we call Introduction to Journalism Studies, which you may recall actually was a reporting continuity and change. So
has it changed?
It has evolved. So I still do the wonderful world of newsreels and magazines and, of course, the onset of the BBC and broadcasting history, etc. I was just wondering, have you got any advice that you'd like to give to Eleanor about, you know, coping with that sort of module from that point of view, the history side of
it? Coping with the history. I remember it was essays that we had to do, and I remember quite reading a few books and getting references on what it was
Read a few books, get a few references.
Yeah. Oh, I can do that, I'm sure. that seems all right.
So go to a library and get a few books about what it was like back then.
Exactly.
But it's always good to know the past, because then you can see, you know, the history of what you worked in. I think it's really important to find out the past of what you worked in, because then how can you view the future? You don't know your past.
Brilliant. Thank you. I'm going to do that. I'm going to read some books.
That's the kind of deep reader philosophy that's made Gabriella a permanent fixture on the Midweek Drive, even when she left the country to escape. It's okay. We can work through that. Okay. David, what have you been getting up to recently in terms of your magic material?
Well, I'm always working about new material. Obviously, thank you again to you, Emma and Kira, for coming to the evening we had back in November at Carriages Cafe. It was a lovely evening. Tomorrow I'm back out again doing some Valentine's Day magic at the same venue at lunchtime.
You make people appear, disappear, causing all sorts of melee
this
and
is
challenges.
It. Yes, yes. So please come along if you want anyone disappeared or vanished. I'll see what I can do.
And Jessica, of course, your first Thursday Midweek Drive Morning Edition, because last week it was an extra special bonus Friday from that point of view. You got it up on time, which is fine, better than Kira, obviously. Emma will be fashionably late, we know that. So any questions you'd like to put to Gabriella?
How's your morning going?
Yeah, good, good. I don't know what I've got up for the rest of the day. I've got some good stories to write. But yeah, it's been a good week, to be honest. I wrote a nice story on coronavirus.
Every story about coronavirus is so nice. Yeah. I mean, the Shakespeare Coriolanus. Oh no, that was another little virus, but still, never mind. Sorry, existed.
There's 10 people locally.
10.
Self isolating. Not any of them have been. None have been tested positive for coronavirus.
But they might be. They might be.
No, I don't. Well, that's my next question. That I'm waiting
exactly.
on. But. They've self-isolated. We've got 10 here that's self-isolated. So,
Siren 107.3.
Sorry, there's a coronavirus infection. Let us never mind. Gabriella, I think we'll ask David to put those last two questions to you. I think you will have it, David.
Definitely, yes. And have you enjoyed your telephonic link today, Gabriella?
I have, thank you.
Superb. And will you come back to join us in the future?
Hopefully next week I'll be back.
7 Gibraltarian Excellent. Days away, or 168 English hours.
Yeah.
the pain, Frida Payne, Band of Gold, all from back in the day. Well, I haven't revealed the news that actually, in terms of the annual Academy Awards challenge between Phil Lynas, of course, in Los Angeles, Emma Tinson this year, fresh entrant into the competition, and of course, Richard Fitzwilliams, royal correspondent and indeed film critic, etc., who actually won. Of course, Jessica, you're aware of who won because Phil Lynas basically went ballistic last night when we informed him. When we informed him that he had scored 6, Emma Tinson had scored 6, and Richard Fitzwilliam scored 7. Yay! Now, claims are, Phil, or rather Richard, Phil's claims are that effectively he predicted 15 out of all the categories. I said I had to compare like with like, because you hadn't predicted all the categories, so you had to stick with the categories that you actually predicted. Don't get me started on that.
I mean, heaven's sakes, you have to stick with the main categories, so, you know, there's no question in going through animated movie, all the rest of it. I stick to the main ones.
Exactly. Jessica, thankfully, managed to calm him down from American to American, so. I think it's okay.
He's breathing.
Well, I mean, if you'd been Sam Mendes on the night, I'm not sure it would have been quite so easy. But I mean, one interesting point. Funnily enough, I've just done a piece on the Oscars to go online shortly, and I mean, of course, there is the opening up with Parasite, which I mean, the people just didn't because there was no pressure group. Such as Me Too or Time's Up, regarding gender equality or diversity and the issues in the nominations for the best director or indeed for the acting nominations, with only one of 20, Cynthia Erivo, who was a person of colour. I mean, it obviously that is not as far from ideal, but there was no pressure group at all, pointing out that there were, in fact, a dozen movies, not in the English language, which had been nominated for Best Picture, none of which had won, including Roma last year, which in my opinion should have, and which brings me to my second point shortly. And also, apparently they've counted 44, they're altered from 36, I see on Wikipedia, that counts for Godfather Part 2 and so forth, where there were subtitles, where there have been nominees who have spoken in non-English or spoken in foreign languages in the Oscar nominations. And half a dozen of them have been nominated more than once. And 3, Sophia Loren, Marianne Cotillard, and Roberta Benigni were the only ones that have won. So this really is opening the door, and the door needed to be opened. And the other point I just wanted to make is, with all the fuss, all the hoopla, and, you know, the deserved win for Parasite, which we're just about to discuss, one issue where Netflix must be burying their head in their hands, because they had 24 nominations and won 2.
Yeah, well, it'll get sorted out, I'm sure, in the fullness of time. Richard, I need to introduce you, of course, to our ace magician, David Fox.
Hello, Richard. How are you today? You keeping well?
Well, certainly. I mean, it's been a very, very busy week
But Richard, at least just the one minor royal story, and that's a divorce, so you don't have to worry too much about the whole thing.
It is admittedly a divorce where Peter Phillips, who is the son of the Princess Royal and Captain Mark Phillips, haven't got a title, nor has Zara, who of course is the Olympian equestrian, but he has made, and this is, of course it's sad, I have 2 daughters, Savannah and Isla, he's 15th in line to the throne, not a working royal, so I mean there's only a limited amount of interest in it, but there has been, I have to say, a lot of wry humour over an advertisement he did for milk in China very recently, where Longleat House, without his permission, was featured, and so was the royal carriage. He sold the wedding, it is reported, for $500,000 when he married St. George's Chapel, Windsor, in 2008, to Hello Magazine. That is not something that a royal should be doing.
Oh, interesting you mention that, Richard, because in the studio making her debut is the awesomely wonderful Eleanor Dean. And Eleanor actually sort of came onto the radar when we were having a discussion about magazines and so on. And basically, Eleanor, very sensible, her parents had kept her away from the little comics and such like stuff. But she was allowed, I believe, Eleanor, to actually purchase a special treat, a royal edition. of a couple of magazines back in the day for 2012?
So 2011, 2012, so when the Royal Wedding was going on.
Oh, William and Kate, yes.
Yes, William and Kate, and then obviously the Diamond Jubilee a year later. I just became fascinated with it, and my parents let me buy, I think it was OK and Hello magazines, and I've still got them in my wardrobe, a bit more tattered, but that was my treat.
It's fair to say, Eleanor, you are quite a royal follower, so I was thinking you must meet Richard Fitzwilliams. Come on the show.
Yeah, well, very nice to meet you, Richard.
Yes, absolutely, because it's certainly been a year, and last year and a bit, in fact, for Royal News, though it is also true that when we say a year for Royal News, and we're not talking about a jubilee or a wedding, there have been, as you know, some pretty sad and disastrous episodes, and when we are the 19th of February, I mean, that week, that's Andrew's 60th birthday, so perhaps we can also dwell on him a bit.
David might be available to win a magic there, perhaps, maybe make it all go away.
Well, you never know.
Well, he certainly would make it go away if he could, no doubt about that.
Yeah, and just from an American perspective, Jessica, your views on the Royals is a case of, well, you got it right back in 1776.
Yeah. Actually, we have a lot of fascination with the royal family in the US. The royal wedding, everyone
is watching. Meghan, North Carolina, do you think that's a possibility? Meghan and Harry in North Carolina, would they accept them? Would they take you in your time?
You know, I don't know about that.
Yeah. You see, exactly. Doesn't know about that, Richard. So, you know, it's interesting.
Well, I mean, I have to say that when it comes to royals, there's no doubt at all. I mean, I was wrong about this. I thought that Harry and Meghan would be a dynamic duo of senior royals following in Diana's footsteps, and that, in fact, a tour, an American tour, or possibly what the Cambridges did, which was a Canadian tour followed by a visit to Los Angeles, and of course they could have elaborated very considerably on just a few days there. I mean, they could have done quite a lot, and had an American tour that would have given them, I thought, the confidence. Of course, I mean, we know what's happened, and also the way it's happened. If we begin on that, we'll never get anywhere near
this
Parasite,
is so true.
By the way.
So, I was saying there's no truth in the rumour that Bong Joon-ho effectively designed Parasite on the basis of an autobiography of Meghan Markle.
I think you could be heading into very
dangerous territory. Dangerous territory.
I mean, Parasite, I mean, just say one thing about the Oscars is I thought 1917 would win. I think most people did. But I did ignore certain signs and knew I was doing it. I did this with Dunkirk and La La Land and Roma. Firstly, the Screen Actors Guild Awards gave Parasite Best Picture. And when that happens, the actors are the largest voting body at the Academy, so you know things are going to be very, very close. Sure, the BAFTAs went for 1917, but the other thing was, this is really most important. It was abundantly clear when I started talking to people who'd seen 1917 that they liked it, and yes, technically they agreed it was brilliant, but they didn't get involved or as emotionally involved in the story, despite the way it was filmed and despite the fact I thought it was a perfect movie. And so, I mean, from that point of view, there were, or shall we say, slight danger signs for 1917.
You talk about danger signs, looks like somebody's actually trying to do some dentistry in the background there, but still, why it's sort of things doing drilling, etc. We don't mind. Richard, move on. Your review of Parasite, if you can squeeze it into the next few moments, over to you.
Well, I mean, director Bong Joon-ho takes a scalpel to the hierarchy of an unjust and unequal society, and the way he does it in Parasite is fascinating, because I mean, I think this is probably the nearest that the Oscars have ever got to rewarding a horror movie. It isn't a typical horror movie, it's a sort of black comedy. I sort of had comedies as well don't do well. The Apartment, Annie Hall, that's all I can think of at the moment when I think Oscars. But it's a phenomenal box office success, and he was drawing apparently in his own experience in working as a tutor for a wealthy family when he was young. So this is a tarantula-like web of intrigue. He sees the rich as capitalist parasites. They exist at a different level, and it's hard for them to realize when subversive forces infiltrate. So there's a house in this movie, and we meet, firstly, we meet in a slum, the Kim family. Kim Taek, played by Song Kang-ho, who's the father. Chung Sook, played by Chang Hwai-hyun, who's the mother. Ki Woo, played by Choi Woo-shik, who is the son, and Ki Jeong, played by Park So-dam, who's the daughter. They're on the breadline. Gradually, they infiltrate an unsuspecting wealthy household, the Park family. Dong Ik, played by Lee Seung-jun, is the father. Jung Yeo, played by Cho Yeo-young, is the mother. And then there are their children, and they can afford to employ a housekeeper and also a chauffeur. But when Ki-woo pretends to be a tutor to Da-hye, who starts romancing, his sister then becomes an art therapist, supposedly, to help Da-song, who these are the children of the Park family. And then, of course, it just so happens the housekeeper and the chauffeur are set up. So, in fact, what you're having is a complete infiltration. But who are the real parasites? Could it be the rich who prey on
society?
No, surely
not. Filmmaking is a metaphor, Richard, surely.
Well,
allegory?
May I say that it's a universally excellent performance, it's first-rate script, and also, and this is one of the things that will grab you out of Parasite, and that is the shocks, because there are surprises in the story. I mean, no spoilers from me. The Residence develops quite a character of its own. It's a wonderfully atmospheric setting for a drama like this. Visually, pretty clinical and unsparing. Obviously, you're highlighting the inequalities in a capitalist society. The poor are in a perpetual cycle of despair.
Could he not have shot it in North Korea as opposed to South Korea? Then he would have actually addressed the balance, perhaps. Just a thought.
Well, you see, the thing is that the rich are not intentionally malign, but
it's the way they are.
Might put a nightmare for them. It's often wickedly funny. Mm. So this is meant to haunt you. And it's an extremely good film.
Okay.
And the reason it won, well, firstly, I mean, 1917 didn't grip as I thought it might. And secondly, remember also one other fact. Since the Oscar So White years of 2015, 2016, 3,500 new members have boosted Academy membership.
And yet, Richard, the rating figures for people viewing the ceremony continue to plummet downwards. There's just
now,
no
that's
place
very
for it.
Sad. In fact, the plummeting ratings went very, very low. Mm, it's extremely
exactly.
serious
yeah.
because it's only
because
about...
Because people have had enough of actors self-congratulating themselves and saying, here are some trinkets, lovey.
And do you know, I expected Alex to play part of Joaquin Phoenix's speech about the artificial insemination of cattle.
So tempted, but I thought, no.
And
I'd
he didn't.
No,
I mean, it was only time. That
yeah. I thought, you know, really in deference to our Norwich correspondent, we held back with respect to that. It's not good. Okay, look quickly around the studio. Jessica, would you be checking out Parasite?
I do plan to. Uh-huh. My friends were talking about it in the Oscars, so it sounds very interesting.
David?
Yes, I've certainly given that a look, and obviously thanks again for filling us in on it, Richard. And last time I was on, it was Joker you were talking about, which is very interesting. So,
well, I mean, Joker
thanks again.
Certainly shakes you up, but the problem with Joker, I thought it's ultra-violent. I mean, yes, Phoenix is superb, but it left
and he won an award, so, you know, one more. You should settle it on that, basically. It's more.
Well, he's a very, very fine actor, and, you know, walked the line, various other roles. He's always been brilliant. Did I admire Joker? It had the impact, no doubt it intended. Did I like it? No.
Richard, I'm sure you'll be checking out Harley Quinn, but maybe not. Maybe nobody is actually on current ratings. Let's move to Eleanor. Parasite?
Yeah, I'd like to. I think it would be... I think it's an important one to check out as well in regards to the fact that it's, you know, the first non-English film to win Best Picture. So it's kind of a historic one, really. So
fantastic.
Yeah.
Good. Richard, you've got 3.5 minutes, if you can, to actually squeeze in The Gentleman.
Well, The Gentleman, I mean, I thought that I'd never see another Guy Ritchie film again voluntarily.
What, after The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Well, I was actually thinking of Revolver and also one called King Arthur, which gave David Beckham his first role.
King Arthur, I mean, it's awesome.
But nonetheless, this is a build as an action comedy. But one of the reasons it works is that it is so ingenious. This is Guy Ritchie managing to get back to lock, stock, and two smoking barrels, level of form, and my goodness, it's outrageous. It works very well, even if sometimes parts of it cheat a bit, because it can use flashbacks. He uses all the techniques he wants to tell a story that's got a lot of gangsters, a lot of big names. And firstly, we meet private investigator, and this is a really sleazy guy, Fletcher, played by Hugh Grant. Grant is excellent, incidentally, at being a rotter, a cad, a bounder, and Fletcher's all of those things. Because Fletcher's investigating about a big day played by Eddie Marson, who was snubbed by drug baron, the American Mickey Pearson, played by very well by Matthew McConaughey at a party. And Fletcher is offering to sell his findings, which typed up as a screenplay called Bush, to Pearson's right-hand man, Raymond, for £20 million. Raymond is Charlie Hunnam. The interesting aspect of this is having, so to speak, typed this up as a form of a screenplay. Well, it means that Richard can do what he likes with the plot, which is precisely what he does do. And when he begins, we watch Follow McConaughey from selling cannabis to students. Heaven forbid such a thing would ever happen anywhere, Lincoln. Building this up by violent means, and also building up an empire. This is clever. Aristocrats need money to keep up their historic homes. So how about a cannabis factory in the grounds, and some of the proceeds go to help the family keep their properties going? I mean, it's a huge business he's built up, but he has done so violently, and he wants to retire with his wife, Rosalind, played by Michelle Dockery, remember Downton Abbey. The problem is selling it. There are Chinese gangsters involved in this plot, and also there is an American billionaire who has every reason for the price of the value of what he's going to buy to come down. Now, this is a very entertaining movie, and I have to say there are a lot of good performances by top actors. As for what goes on and whether or not it's truly believable and whether or not you buy what you see, don't believe the first scene. I will say that. That's the only spoiler alert. Facts are that this is entertaining, and Grant is gloriously sleazy. Okay. It's wonderful to see him back on form, and to see Guy Ritchie back on form, I never thought I'd see it.
Hey, listen, he had difficulty being Mr. Madonna for a few years, so there were issues there with respect to relationship that didn't quite work out. But let's move to Jessica. Will you be checking out The Gentleman?
Well, definitely, now that I know that Michelle Dockery is in it. I had no idea.
Well, there you are. Exactly.
Well, a gangster's mole, a tricky role, you know.
Essential.
If you want to retire, the problem is you've got to get the money, but if you want a very large amount of money for all these extraordinary...
It's always a quandary. Time is ticking on. David, the gentleman, yes or no?
I would say yes, definitely,
okay.
Once
Ella,
again.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Excellent. Right, last two questions for Richard, please. Jessica.
Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Yes, I have. Indeed, I have.
Awesome. And will you be joining us again?
I look forward very much.
Yes, it is Radio Day. In fact, it's the joy of World Radio Day, specifically UNESCO's World Radio Day, hence On My Radio, The Selector. And who better to actually talk about some of the positive effects of radio in the United Kingdom, like Siren Radio, of course, than that awesome psychologist, general all-round wonderful soul, who is Dr. Becky Spellman. How are you, Becky?
I'm good, Alex. Happy World Radio Day.
Yeah, exactly. We're all happy on that. We've got three fine co-hosts in the studio. You've got magician David Fox. You're happy it's World Radio Day, aren't you, David?
I certainly am, yes. Great to be here.
And making a debut on the Midweek Dry Morning Edition, we have our undergraduate journalism student, the wonderful Eleanor Dean. You're happy it's World Radio Day, aren't you, Eleanor?
Couldn't be happier.
And from America, from North Carolina, of course, Jessica Burtis. You're also happy it's World Radio Day.
Yes, I had no idea.
Exactly. We didn't. So Becky, talk to us about this fabulous sort of World Radio Day, the day before the St. Valentine's Day scenario, in which astonishingly we don't see you in the top 10 of people most want to listen to, Becky. You know, I was astounded, but still.
Yes, yeah, I know, I was surprised too. Well, amazingly enough, we actually found that 42% of people use radio as a companion when feeling lonely in the East Midlands. And that was research done by Pure, which is a leading digital radio brand. So it's quite interesting because loneliness is a problem. One in five affected by loneliness, and the average Brit feels lonely 2 days a week. A large percentage of people also go many days without speaking to anyone. But actually, it's great to know that something as simple as radio can actually help alleviate loneliness for many people.
Well, as we'd like to say, nobody need feel alone when they're listening to the Midweek Drive, because you're part of the team, even if you're not in the studio. David, you've had a chance to have a look at this particular story. Any questions you'd like to put to Becky?
Well, obviously nice to talk to you today, Dr. Spellman.
Thank you.
He's from Scotland, Becky. He likes to use the formalities. You know, hey, Dr. Well, Spellman. Well, hey.
Love it.
And for how long have you been interested in radio? Has it been a lifelong passion for yourself?
Well, I've always loved radio, but I was first on radio about, I don't know, like 10 years ago. I did my first radio interview. I was so nervous because it was live. And, you know, exposure therapy is brilliant because once you do things a few times, you stop feeling so anxious about it. But it's great. You know, it's different from TV. I think it really brings people together. And, you know, it's nice that listeners can actually phone in and engage. And the topics as well, like chat radio is absolutely amazing. You get so much from it. It really stimulates the mind.
It's interesting you talked about exposure therapy, because it was something when Eleanor said, I'm a bit nervous about this, etc. I was very tempted the other day to actually say, don't worry, Eleanor, I'm just going to use exposure therapy to actually sort of work this process.
It works, I agree. I was a patient myself when I put myself through the exposure therapy of speaking on live radio. It gets easier.
And we've never looked back. Over in the States, radio, I mean, again, mm-hmm. I've been talking to you about obviously radio and the way it's been developing in terms of communications and in society. Yeah. But from your own perspective, Jessica, any thoughts or questions from radio in the States? Does it also serve as a companion, a friend?
It does. I think most Americans listen to it in the car all the time. Someone always has the radio on. I think it's nice too, because in the US we're so spread out, so it's nice to feel connected. I listen to radio in California, and it makes it feel a bit more cohesive.
Yeah.
And daily habits, of course, people surveyed say they most often listen to radio exactly on that basis, driving on the way to or from work, cooking in the kitchen, is there, relaxing in the living room. I thought you spent most time on a PlayStation there. Third also said that they listen to the radio once or twice a day. How often do you listen to the radio, Eleanor, if at all?
Well, I obviously have, when I was younger, it used to be to and from in the car, but I think nowadays with the introduction of like aux cords and people being able to connect their phones to their cars, I think people listen to it a lot less, which I think is quite sad, because I remember coming home from when I was swimming and listening to the radio on the way back, and the familiar voices, again, waking up in the morning and hearing the radio, whereas nowadays you don't hear it nearly as much. And I think it's an important tool for people to use to kind of hear news and hear stories and as well as music and entertainment.
And of course, Becky, there are also the podcast phenomena, etc., that people often choose what audio they want to listen to, and they'll create their own kind of radio stations.
Podcasts are amazing, and the quality of podcasts has just, over the last couple of years, it's just phenomenal that they're producing this like really top quality production and putting so much like effort into it. And it's amazing. With podcasts, you can choose exactly what you're interested in, and the options are just unbelievable.
We want more Becky Spellman podcasts, by the way. That's the official line. It's coming out. Obviously, be part of this Siren Radio podcast, but we need a Becky Spellman authentic podcast. It'll take that Peter Crouch podcast and put it into a cocked hat, you know, there. Were you surprised, Becky, by the kind of list of the top favourite radio presenters? I mean, Justin Webb in at 10 and Sarah Cox at number 1 with Jeremy Vine and Zoe Ball tying for second place. Chris Evans, well, surely, I mean, he's at the same time as we are, so he's got, I mean, you know, he might as well give up. he's headed up on that basis. Any surprises there?
No, I wasn't surprised. They're all familiar names, and, like, you know, we all have personalities that we're particularly drawn to, and when we decide we like, you know, someone's personality, we just feel like we know that person. You know, we get very familiar with the tone of their voice and also the kind of things that they're going to say and the routes they're going to go down with their interviews. So it's almost like listening to a friend, and it's, you know, if you are sort of looking to engage with people but don't necessarily have lots of, like, face-to-face contact, it's, you know, it's just amazing to be able to tune into the personalities that you like, and it's a massive mood booster to be able to listen to these presenters.
Of course, there is an argument that suggests that in the commercial world of broadcasting, personality is the last thing you want your presenters to have, because you want to actually make sure that the advertisements get out there. But let's not go down that routine, because that's another issue entirely. It is actually quite sobering when we look at the finding that the average British soul actually feels lonely for 2 days a week. One in four say they'll sometimes go days without speaking to anyone, and one in ten also admit that they only speak to other people at work, which is, I suppose if it's choice, but again, Becky, you'd have to say that's not necessarily the best for social beings that human creatures are.
Yeah, it is surprising. And of course, loneliness is not just about, like, how many friends you have or a lack of friends. You can feel lonely and be surrounded by lots of people, because it's different from solitude, which is the choice you're choosing, being alone with solitude. But loneliness is just this feeling that you have inside, and that might be that you're, you know, you've lots of people around you, but you have that feeling of loneliness. So, it was quite surprising, actually, the research, and like, to find out how lonely people in Britain actually are.
And I think, if memory serves, when we first spoke, I need to sort of qualify whereabouts from the Republic of Ireland were you from? And the answer, Becky, was
Tipperary.
There you are, you see. It's a long way to Tipperary. Still working through that process. Any other questions, Eleanor, that you want to put to Becky at this stage about the research or indeed World Radio Day?
I guess, what do you see radio in the next 5 to 10 years down the line, obviously with the growth of Spotify, podcasts, people using BBC News apps? Do you think radio is still going to be as prominent as it is now 10 years down the line? Do you think there's room for it to move?
Of course, because everything that is good evolves and innovates, and there is so many radio stations out there that there's going to be amazing creative minds who just evolve with the times and go where things are going. You know, and it's technical. Like, anything tech is cool and trendy, and there's loads of room for innovation with it. So we're always going to have radio.
And Jessica?
I was just wondering, have you ever found yourself maybe turning to the radio when you need, like, a little emotional boost and just kind of listening in?
My patients don't understand me. I'm just a psychologist, honestly.
Yeah, I think, like, actually talk radio or podcasts or anything that's, like, informative and chatty, for me it's like watching a documentary. You know, it, like, stimulates your mind and gives you all these creative new ideas that you hadn't actually thought about. And you know, it completely alleviates a loneliness, because your mind is in this place of being stimulated, which is, for me, it's very hard to feel lonely and also feeling really sort of inspired at the same time.
And I must actually use that phrase, exposure therapy. I think it could have all sorts of ramifications in terms of booking new folk for the Midweek Drive, Morning Editions Plus. Becky, it has been, as we knew it would be, absolutely awesome. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on...
It's been an amazing experience yet again.
Oh, wow.
And if people are interested in this research, for more information, they can go to pure.com, which is, as I mentioned, a leading digital radio brand.
You see, that's the quality that you're actually bringing to bear, Becky. And constant professionalism can even go to that notion of finding out further details without even having to be prompted. It's just genius. Becky, will you be kind enough to return in the very near future?
I always enjoy it, so I'd love to return.
Now, clearly the big question that needs to be asked on this day before Valentine's Day is, who is your best friend? Is your mum your best friend? This mother-daughter bond. Let's just quickly test out those sort of lines with two of our wonderful fine folk in the studio. First of all, Jessica from North Carolina, is your mum your best friend?
Yes, she's actually listening right now.
Wow. When in North Carolina, it must be, what, 2 a.m. in the morning?
It's like 3 a.m.
3 a.m. in the morning, and she's still listening.
She wanted to listen.
A shout-out to Camille.
Yeah.
Yay! And Ellen. Eleanor, is your mum your best friend?
She is. I don't know whether she's listening or not. She's probably
she's
still
in
bed.
Exactly.
She's in Norwich. Who's up in Norwich?
40 minutes to 9 o'clock.
Exactly. But yeah, she is. She definitely
is. This clearly confirms theories that have been put forward by our next guest on the programme, best-selling romantic novelist extraordinaire. It's the wonderful Katie Ford. How are you, Katie?
I'm fine, thank you very much, on this beautiful day.
Indeed. Now, your latest book, A Springtime Affair, of course, released on the 20th of February. It's all about mother-daughter dynamics. You've heard from two of our co-hosts in the studio from that point of view. It would seem that when it comes to daughters, you're absolutely right, Katie.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that my daughter is my best friend. We had a little chat about it the other day. I know. It's just that we both said we love each other, we love spending time together, we have a lot of fun, we do anything for each other, we've always got each other's back, which is like a friend. Mm. But if I had a problem, if I had a lump or something, she wouldn't be the first one I'd tell, because I'm always protecting her from, you know, anything that might be worrying for her. And then so if I did have a lump, I'd tell a friend and they would have to deal with my emotions. And then by the time I'd got to my daughter, I'd have, you know, been to a doctor and said, you know, had it checked out or something. Mm. And then I'd tell her. But I wouldn't tell her every little thing about my life if I thought they would worry her, those details. I just think we do protect each other. And she agreed, we both agreed, that we wouldn't tell each other too many intimate details about our lives. Although we really do support each other and love each other and, as I say, have a lot of fun.
Now, allowing for reverse psychology, clearly, if I'm going to put this question to Jessica, whose mum might be listening at this present time, either answer is going to be challenging, because you could say, of course I'd share any challenges with her, or I won't say any, and you say, what's going on, Jessica? What's on? What are your thoughts on this particular finding, Jessica, this survey?
I think it just depends on kind of the issues that maybe they're sharing. I know some people wouldn't want to share an issue with their parents because they would feel like they don't want to cause any trouble, at least.
I mean, 25% of mothers and daughters say they've become better friends over the years. 21% say that becoming parents or grandparents themselves has brought them closer together. I mean, in the text, you've got obviously the relationship between Jilly and her daughter, Helena. Was it partly autobiographical, Katie, that you were developing on this one?
No, actually.
No.
I mean, the relationship was autobiographical.
Yeah.
But I'm still married after nearly 48 years, you know, I'm not dating.
Yeah.
But I can see that my daughter would be worried if I was, you know, younger and, you know, single and looking at men. I can see that she would check them out and that she would worry and she would criticise them. Whereas me, as a mother, I've never said anything bad about any of her boyfriends because I've always felt,
well,
if they're
back.
Really dreadful,
control.
Get rid of them. And if they're not, they're fine. And actually, had I been able to choose her present husband, I would have done because he is so lovely.
Mm.
So, you know, but I think that's where the mother and the daughter thing is a bit different. Because I think the daughter could be franker than the mother can.
See. We also have David Fox, who's a magician in the studio. David and myself, our mums are no longer with us, so it's a challenging time from that point of view. But at the same time, I've often said parents can be quite difficult to bring into the world. It's bottom line.
Well, it's that was reverse psychology there, wasn't it? Yes. but they're always with us, though. I mean, we'd agree that. I mean, I was very close to my mum, and yes, it's very important.
My point being, Katie, is can this also apply for sons and daughters, or sons and fathers?
Oh, yes,
or,
I think sons also look out for you. And my sons are quite, you know, they will tell me if they think I'm doing anything
Mum,
wrong.
Mum, don't do those radio interviews. Stop it now. Go away. Eleanor, any questions you'd like to put to Katie about life, the universe, or indeed the springtime affair, which kind of it says does exactly what it says it's going to do in many ways.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what made you come up with this idea and how long did it take for you to develop it and then get round to writing it?
Well, I couldn't believe I hadn't written about mothers and daughters before because it seemed such a rich theme and so much fun. But then I realised I hadn't, and I was very relieved because it's always nice to find a new idea after 25 books. And so I just thought, well, this is what I want to write about. And I quite quickly had the idea about the family home that the wife lives in, and then the son thinking, well, you're sitting on all this money with this family, this lovely family home that you've always had. Maybe you should sell it and share the money, and which I think is a dilemma for parents all over the world. You think you're, particularly now in England, when property is so ridiculously expensive, if you want your children to get on the property ladder, maybe you have to get out of your lovely Cotswold stone house and share the money out a bit. And so those dilemmas are very present, and I thought they're all fun to write about. And, of course, Gilly and Helena do have fun together.
Looking at some of the awesome texts you've actually produced over the years, I mean, Katie Ford, of course, A Vintage Wedding, A Summer at Sea, A Secret Garden, A Country Escape, A Rose Petal Summer, The Christmas Stocking, Highland Fling. That's particularly interesting, that one, Highland Fling, from that point of view. Is there a particular favourite, Katie, or is that a case? Don't be silly, I can't choose between my books. It's like choosing which one for children I actually go for.
Well, I do feel rather like that about my books. And I'm always in love with the one I'm writing, which, of course, isn't either of these mentioned here, because, I'm on to the next book. Yeah. But I did love writing A Rose Petal Summer, because it did sort of spread over several things I love. It has my Dutch barge in it, which I love, and is in Canary Wharf, and I just been staying there tonight and took some lovely pictures from there. It's got Scotland in it. I love writing about Scotland. I spent a lot of time there. And I always love writing about it. And it's also got France, which I also love. So I did have huge fun writing that book. So it can be my current favourite, and it is out now in paperback, so it's sort of appropriate for it to be my favourite. But actually, the one I'm on is always the favourite, because that's the child that you're nurturing at home. The others have left school, and they're all right. You know, they're off. They've left home. They're doing their own thing, and you love them, and you care about them. But you don't need to look after them like the book you have at home that you're either writing or has just come out.
Where they go. Now, clearly, I would suggest go to Katie Ford, that's FFORDE.com, for further information, including a fantastic set of blogs, very useful blogs, even for that, which is amazing. Is there any other place that you'd recommend people should check out your fine, outstanding writing, Katie?
Well, of all good bookshops, as they say, and probably all good supermarkets as well. Especially for the paperback. So, yes, I hope I'm available to everybody everywhere. And also, don't forget your library. Good old libraries, they do so much for us all. We must support them.
And just confirming that the work of Tim Berners-Lee isn't in vain, is it true, Katie, that your great-grandfather was Sir Alexander Penrose Gordon Cumming of Attire?
Yes.
Marvellous.
My grandfather with Sir William Gordon Cumming. He had a lot of scandal attached to his name, the Baccarat case. So, yes, very scandalous ancestors in my house. Yeah. But I've lived to overcome it, and all is well.
That's what we have to do. Yeah. And when you mention Cumming, of course, one thinks that Dominic can best not go there, really, because it's different.
Well, yes, let's not. No, absolutely, let's not.
Step away from the political routine.
Katie, away from the Cumming.
It's been sensational connecting with your good self this morning. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
I've had a great time. I think it's a great show. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Well, Katie, it's been a genuine delight. A round of applause for Katie Ford, please. Hopefully we'll speak again when the next text is emerging. Will you come back?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
When I look back to see those blue skies, were they better days between the hellos and the goodbyes, the promises we made? And looking back, we had the chances. How many did we throw away? But you can't go back just to start it all over. No second chances.
just a start in an overflowing second chance is time. And all I have looking over my shoulder is just a memory of you. Starting an overflowing second chance is time. It's time. And all I have looking over my shoulder is just a memory of you. And the world we left behind. The world we left behind. And all I have looking over my shoulder is just a memory of you.
Is and the world we left behind. Well, it seems that we've left a lot behind in Britain over the last 9 years, 10 years actually, since 2010. Ordnance Survey, they're the mapping people who actually look to ensure that everything is mapped out appropriately and ensure that actually Eleanor can actually safely get from Norwich to Lincoln and back again safely, and David can get do the same thing from Norwich, well, actually from Norwich, from Nottingham to Lincoln and so on. And 20,000 changes every day have been made since 2010. 20,000 changes every day in terms of the National Geographic Database of Great Britain. We're going to be talking to one of the folk from Ordnance Survey to explain how do they cope. Mark Cuthbert is the gentleman's name, with how the face of the nation has changed in terms of its map over the decade and so on. I don't know, just point it in the direction and hope for the best, really. We're also going to be finding out about how guide dogs are setting up a campaign, really, to actually stop motorists parking on curbs. It's not good for guide dogs and a variety of other things as well. And from Debrett's, in terms of netiquette and the appropriate things to actually do in terms of messaging your match. Apparently, yes, people are using bad grammar, misspelling and poor punctuation when they're actually using their Messenger Facebook apps as well. Exactly, Eleanor. My feelings, precisely. That's why you're on the programme. Up next, it's the news from the Sky News Centre. And then we'll be starting off with a whole heap of good material on Sirens Midweek Drive Morning Edition. OK, and the weather today for Lincoln, highs of 8 degrees centigrade, lows of zero. It's going to be a day of heavy rain and fresh breezes. So, not good weather for mapping. Although, is it ever good weather for mapping? I don't know. Maybe it's every day is good weather for mapping, particularly when it comes to ordnance surveys. And to talk about that and this National Geographic Ordnance Survey, Shape of the Nation, we're delighted to welcome Mark Cuthbert. How are you, Mark?
Morning, everyone.
Good.
Morning.
Excellent. Oh, on for a minute. We were staggered, this survey that basically since 2010, over 20,000 changes every day have been made. 360 million changes that Ordnance Survey has actually made to the National Geographic Database of Great Britain. Is the island changing literally every second that we speak?
It changes all the time. There's never anything that stops. Wherever you see change, an Ordnance Survey surveyor will be looking to get that on the map and get it for people to use for good as soon as we can.
Now, I'm probably one of the generation that still remembers when Ordnance Survey maps were there and we'd have a school trip and you'd have to navigate yourself across the North York Moors. I don't know why, but, you know, it was some sort of reason that was actually there. In this computer-generated world of GPS, etc., does your data get fed into that these days? It's a case of we trust from the sat-nav, we can't read a map, or other variations of combinations that we put together for this?
Well, Ordnance Survey's database, the big servers down here, have got 500 million features in there. You referenced the 20,000 changes a day. That's a combination of surveyors. It's a combination of imagery from planes all going into a database that's for people to use. It's 2 terabytes of data. I don't even know what 2 terabytes of data is, really,
it's a lot,
to be honest.
It's a lot. Yeah.
But it sounds like a lot to me. Yeah. We've got 200 surveyors going around the country daily, literally. Going back to what you said, is it always a nice day to do it? In Ordnance Survey terms, every day is a good day.
Exactly.
You know, we've got basically waterproof surveyors need to be out there collecting the data for people to use. And the paper mats are just derived. They're just made from that big database. Mm. So we can squirt out all sorts of different things from that database.
As you said, the largest geospatial database for a single country in the world. Is that including America as well?
Well, America's in lots of different chunks, actually. The way they're organised is in different chunks. So we can claim it. In that sense.
And we will. Even though we have our North Carolina correspondent in the studio with us, sort of saying, but surely that's not the case.
We'd certainly like to think Ordnance Survey has some element of putting the great into Great Britain from a mapping sense. There's lots of countries come to Ordnance Survey for thought leadership around mapping and all sorts of stuff like that. We like to help other countries with their problems to do with mapping, so... It's certainly, we're in a good place from that point of view.
Well, Lewis and Clark, the sort of Mason-Dixie line, all of those kind of critical things all start with map-making. Indeed, even James Cook actually went off on a map-making exercise. But let's turn back to the United Kingdom. Fascinating to find in terms of the breakdown of land use as of the 1st of January this year. Agricultural land, just under half, 45% of land out there is agricultural. 25%, a quarter, is natural environment. 14% is woodland. And man-made surfaces, excluding buildings, 3.8%. Is that roads and such that? And will HS2 basically say, well, that'll knock it up to about 20%?
I don't think HS2 will knock it up to 20%. It's actually quite a small percentage of the country is actually man-made, if you think about it. It's only 88% of is urban in the whole of this country, which is actually quite a small amount of actually man-made land, really, in the scheme of things.
And of course,
it has grown.
Yeah, buildings 1.4%, 4.5% for others. That's including tidal and rail. Water 1.6%. I mean, obviously you're the expert in this particular line. Were you surprised by those figures, or I mean, are there any times when you actually say this? That can't be right.
There's an element of where you go, is it really or isn't it? But when you actually dig under the detail and think about it, it actually probably isn't, because rivers aren't actually that wide in that sense. They're fast flowing. So there is a lot of just general land. The database is there to answer questions that can be posed. So, and it helps with decisions to be made. So if anyone just wants to ask about how do we improve our bin collection routes and things like that, they can use the database and the data that's in that to help make things better for everyone. And that's what Ordnance Survey is all about. It's like the sort of hidden thread that helps other people. It's the people who everyone who's listening rely on Ordnance Survey data in some form or other every day.
I'm particularly drawn to the Queen's Ferry Bridge in Scotland, which obviously leads to David Fox. David, any questions that you'd like to add or indeed ask to our ace Ordnance Survey soul, Mark, at present?
Of course, though. It's lovely to hear from you today. And in terms of your actual career, what was it that enticed you towards working with Ordnance Survey? Is it something an area you've always been interested in?
I mean, it sounds daft. I'm a Boy Scout.
Dad was a Boy Scout leader. Yes, yeah.
I was, I think your presenter actually referenced walking across the moors.
Yes.
I would say I'm a moors boy, and my dad was a moors man. So I always had that love of maps, and as you do when you leave school, you write away to all sorts of different places.
Oh.
And I got a letter back from Ordnance Survey saying, come for a test. And
superb.
I literally left with my backpack from the northeast and headed down to Southampton to be trained when I was 17 and a week. So 33 years ago, I did that, and I've been with Ordnance Survey ever since. Done all sorts of things.
There's got to be a movie that's going to be made about this. You know, it's the life and times of Mark Cuthbert, a lad from Yorkshire, who mapped the country. It's genius.
I wish. yeah.
Eleanor, I don't know, when you were at school, did you do geography and things from that point of view? Were you a secret ordnance survey fan? Oh, I mean, wearing, of course, your RAF credentials, maybe it is a case. You need those mappers.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to have said that due to that, I had an interest. I was never very good at geography. I never had a very good strong point with it. But saying that, like, I always find it interesting to hear about other people who do. My brother's particularly very good at geography. He's got a real gift with it, so it's really nice to hear people that are, you know, that have a passion with it. So yeah,
it just goes to show that when it comes to geography, even though we might have various nightmarish flashbacks from time spent at school, you know, it's still good in the end. Mark, where can people go to find out further details about this changing Ordnance Survey shape of the nation?
Well, you can go onto the Ordnance Survey website, os.uk. There's all sorts of different information there. There's lots of blogs. There's lots of YouTube videos of things that we've done. There's lots of things about actually why Ordnance Survey helps more than you think. The data, it's not just a mapping company. It's a it's actually a big data company, and we help lots of people through answering those questions. So local councils, the government, going from where bridges are being built, like you said, the Queen's Ferry one, where schools are getting built, where we've got housing estates, all that sort of stuff.
Even
utility.
The mini roundabout in Llandudno now. Who would have thought that we'd actually be mentioning on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition from Lincoln, England, the mini roundabout in Llandudno now. Just goes to show. Awesome.
It can be big change.
Or teeny tiny ones. Exactly. It's just great.
Yeah, I mean, US embassies right down to...
Well, they're obviously going to be big changes, aren't they?
Yeah.
Really, because of the way
but even down to just a bank that changes to a pub on the corner of the street, that sort of level of change. It might not be a map change, but it's actually the what it is change is also what Ordnance Survey collects.
And I'm almost tempted there to conclude, Mark, by the classic line, when it comes to Ordnance Survey, National Geographic Ordnance Survey, quite frankly, it is what it is. Or maybe it isn't. Mark, it's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self today. Take care, and I'm sure we'll speak again very soon. Probably if every change has been made, by the time we next speak, you know, there'll be another 40,000 changes made. Amazing.
Quite possibly. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Jeremiah Dixon, I am a Geordie boy. Glass of wine with you, sir, and the ladies I'll enjoy. All Durham and Northumberland is measured up by my own hand. It was my fate from birth to make my mark upon the earth.
He calls me Charlie Mason, stargazer am I. It seems that I was born to chart the evening sky. They've cut me out for baking bread, but I had other dreams instead. This baker's boy from the West Country would join the Royal Society. We are sailing to Philadelphia, a world away from the coaly tide. Sailing to Philadelphia to draw the line, the Mason-Dixon line. Surveyor Dixon, but I swear you'll make me mad. The West will kill us both, you gullible Geordie lad. You talk of liberty, how can America be free? A Geordie and a baker's boy in the forests of the Iroquois.
Now hold your head up, miss, and see America lies there. Morning tide has raised the capes of Delaware. Come up and feel the sun, a new morning has begun. Another day will make it clear why your star should guide us here. We are sailing to Philadelphia, a world away from the coldly tide. Sailing to Philadelphia to draw the line. The Mason Dixon line.
Magic show in the studio. We now move on to the topic of guide dogs, and in particular guide dogs and pavement parking, which is not good for guide dogs, especially when you bear in mind that over 95% of people with sight loss have been forced to walk in the road due to pavement parking. So to talk about this and more, we're delighted to welcome from, of course, guide dogs, the wonderful Helen Honstvedt. How are you, Helen?
Hi, I'm good, thank you.
And your doggy friend as well in the background, whose name is Henry, I believe.
Yes, that's true, and he's here with his owner, Gordon.
Excellent. Hello, Gordon. Hello, Henry.
Hi, Alex.
Yeah, this is good stuff. Gordon, talk us through your own experience with this, and presumably Henry's as well. When you're happily going along the road, you think, not another car parked on the pavement.
It's everyday occurrence, and sometimes they're parked on both sides of the road, so we have to go down the middle of the road.
Which is actually illegal, dangerous, and all sorts of problems from that point of view. I mean, Helen, from your own perspective within guide dogs, I mean, clearly guide dogs do such a fantastic and essential part in terms of help with visually impaired folk and so on. 360,000 people are registered blind or partially sighted. 2.3 million people actually live with sight loss in the UK. Talk to us about this report, Blocked In, the Impact of Pavement Parking.
So we did a survey last spring, which 1,800 people took part in, and it wasn't just for people who are blind and partially sighted. We also asked a lot of other pedestrian groups as well. And what we found from that was that the vast majority of pedestrians have encountered pavement parking, and it causes particular challenges to obviously people with sight loss, but also other disabled people, including wheelchair users and mobility scooter users, older people, and parents with prams and young children as well. And the reason that it's so dangerous is that it can force people to go out into the road and into oncoming traffic to get around parked cars. Often this can be on very busy roads or outside of schools, and it's resulting in people being injured. So actually one in five people with a sight loss have injured, suffered an injury trying to get around a vehicle. And there's also can be an impact on people's confidence as well. So not knowing whether you're going to be able to safely get down the street or not can prevent people from going out on their own. And the whole point of guide dogs is to enable people to live the life that they choose independently, and pavement parking is undermining that. So what we're looking for is a law across England which would bring into place the situation that we've got in London, which is when you can't park on pavement unless the council has specifically decided that that's a road where it should be allowed. So, for example, because of emergency vehicle access or residential parking. And then the council can make sure that if any pavement parking takes place, that hopefully enough space is left on the pavement for pedestrian users, or that there's a safe route for people to get down the road. Because people's experiences in London are much better than the rest of the UK. And we think that your access to safe pavement should be equal wherever you live in England.
OK, a number of points there, and I love the fact that Henry is just sort of saying, yes, you tell him, in sort of canine speak. So it's great stuff there. Let's turn to some of our team in the studio here. Eleanor in Norwich, what's the situation there?
With regards to guide dogs or...
And indeed pavement parking.
Pavement parking, it's not very good at all. Our roads are quite small, and I know where I live personally, there is nowhere near enough parking. So a lot of the time, there's a lot of parking on the pavements, especially near the local schools. There's double yellow lines, but because the car parks and places aren't big enough, and there's two schools quite close together, a lot of people tend to park on the pavements, and there's been a lot of people obviously posting on Facebook and online pictures and naming and shaming a lot of cars, and which has resulted in a lot of kids having to walk in and out of cars and weave, and it's quite dangerous. It is dangerous, especially near schools.
And let's turn to Beverly. Beverly, not as sort of urban an area as Norwich, obviously, but in Horncastle, the situation over there?
Well, in Gainsborough, are you talking?
Gainsborough, yes, sorry, I was very confusing.
Yeah, like you said, it's not urbanised so much so like in Lincoln. But didn't Lincoln bring in the law?
We
did something about this in journalism a couple of months ago. They were bringing in a law. It could be March the 1st, actually.
Helen, is this true? Is Lincoln ahead of the world in this? Are we sort of following the way forward on this one?
I don't know specifically about Lincoln, but I can tell you that councils do have a way of doing it through something called a traffic regulation order. Mm-hmm. But what councils have told us is that's a really expensive and difficult way of introducing laws on pavement parking, because you have to have signage on each entry and exit point of the non-pavement parking zone, and there's also some expensive public consultation happening. And so councils via the local government association are supporting us in calling for this nationwide law, so that no matter where you live, it's the same law. And that would, council thinks that through having these powers, that would make it much easier, because they don't have the right powers at the moment.
David, Nottingham or Scotland, what your choice?
Well, I mean, as Eleanor was saying, it's similar in Nottingham. There's a lot of pavement parking, very congested around there. I was down in Sherwood yesterday, and it's quite tricky to get parked around these parts.
So Henry would not be a happy canine.
Well, certainly it's very important to flag this up, Helen. Yes, it's something that many people just won't realise. It's very important.
From the point of view of North Carolina, I mean, what's the situation in there? Is it just a case of we're American, we put the automobile at the number one row?
So this might be a very American question, but pavements, that's
sidewalk, exactly. Very true, exactly.
I thought so. I don't think I've really ever seen, unless there's like a festival happening, people parking on the sidewalk.
See, obviously, better mannered in the States, Helen, clearly, in terms of that whole sort of sequence. So, understand. I mean, Helen, the way forward in terms of this, people listening to this, quite clearly they appreciate Gordon's got a challenge, Henry's got a challenge, guide dogs have a challenge. What's the best way for people to actually support this whole thing and, again, get a ban on pavement parking put in place?
So we've been calling on the government to take action on this for many years, and in fact over 1,500 days ago the government promised to take action and research into solutions, and we're still waiting for that to happen, even though a parliamentary committee of MPs at the end of last year agreed with us that this should happen. We've got a petition running that people can sign at guidedogs.org.uk, or you can contact your MP and say that this is a really important issue to you and you think they should take action on it.
And I think we'll have to follow through with respect to that. And we will in all sorts of ways. For the moment, though, it's been fascinating having to focus on that. How's Henry being on this radio day, Gordon? I mean, is he sort of all set up
very
for this?
Very vocal.
Yeah, which is good. I mean, we like that. We like to ensure that he's good, because it's nice. I mean, you know, a quick to Henry, just from friendly local neighbourhood presenter there. And I'm sure we'll speak again in the very near future. Take care, gentlemen. Well, both Helen and Gordon and Henry. Farewell.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers to the wish you were here, but you're not. Cause the drinks bring back all the memories of everything we've been through. Toast to the ones in today. Toast to the ones that we lost on the way. Cause the drinks bring back all the memories. And the memories bring back your. There's a time that I remember when I did not know no pain. When I believed in forever and everything would stay the same. Now my heart feel like December when somebody say your name. Cause I can't reach out to call you, but I know I will one day, hey. Everybody hurts sometimes, everybody hurts someday, hey, hey. But everything gon' be alright, gon' raise a glass and say, hey. Here's to the ones that we got. Cheers to the wish you were here, but you're not. Cause the drinks bring back all the memories of everything we've been through. Toast to the ones here today. Toast to the ones that we lost on the way. Cause the drinks bring back all the memories. And the memories bring back your. Memories bring back your. There's a time that I remember when I never felt so lost. And I felt all of the hatred was too powerful to stop. Now my heart feels like an ember and it's lighting up the dark. I'll carry these torches for you, and you know I'll never drop. Yeah. Everybody hurts sometimes, everybody hurts someday. Yeah, yeah. But everything gon' be alright. Gonna raise a glass and say, hey. Here's to the ones that we got. Cheers to the wish you were here, but you're not. Cause the drinks bring back all the memories of everything we've been through. Toast to the ones here today. Toast to the ones that we lost on the way. Cause the drinks bring back all the memories. And the memories bring back your.
Memories do. Maureen 5. Okay, we've been joined in the studio. You may have heard a voice earlier by Gainsborough's finest, of course. It is one and only Beverly Spencer. How are you, Beverly?
Hello. Good. Very good.
Marvellous.
Thank you.
And also Emma Street, who has basically spent half an hour just standing outside, kind of doing things. It's all right. It's away. How are you, Emma?
Oh, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. That's splendid. This is all good. In a few seconds' time, we're going to be speaking to Catherine Lewis from Debrett's on the ultimate do's and don'ts when messaging in terms of certainly the Valentine's Day scenario. The ultimate do's and don'ts. Apparently, etiquette plays a great deal in terms of this. Technically, it's netiquette. Timing is all important when keeping your virtual sweetheart sweet. Gone are the days when you could keep your crush hanging on for 3 days to message back. Almost half of the nation will reply within 24 hours. In fact, 28% of Messenger users apparently reckon taking too long to reply is bad etiquette, while 35% believe it's rude to read a message and not respond. Just don't get me started on the sort of the domination of social media and various other bits and pieces. Honestly. We'll be finding out more about that. David might have one or two magic routines because obviously you've been doing... I mean, how did we find that? Because it's the first time, obviously, from the point of view of Jessica and Eleanor and indeed Beverly, you've seen David at close quarters. In fact, ever seen him really from that point of view. So, yeah. Were you impressed?
Yes. It was
oh my
so
God,
good.
It was amazing. Love a bit of magic.
Yeah. Well, thank the checks in the post. Thank you for that.
And David, how can people actually, if they want to book you, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, thank you. My website's www.magician-midlands.co.uk. And I'm always delighted to perform. I do a lot of weddings, parties, corporate events.
Not as funerals, though.
Well, I have been asked, actually, for a magician. It's a funny thing. But
bring them back to life! I can't do that!
I was just saying to Emma, thanks again to you, Emma and Kira, for coming to see me at Carriages in November. It was a lovely evening. Yeah, it was great to see you all. So.
The great drive routine from that point. I think Emma's already booking in the date for this time next year. So who knows what
can happen. Well, who knows what can happen.
Yeah. Ah, amazing. Anyway, Netiquette coming up. Here are Tones and I. Attention in terms of the team and various other factors, you'll find as we approach, well, actually just past 32 minutes past 9 o'clock, in the studio we have Emma Street, and we have Jessica Burtis, and we have Beverly Spencer, and David Fox, and Eleanor Dean. We haven't actually got our Debrett's Peerage person because the number doesn't seem to be connecting. I have sent out a message to do that. They probably won't reply because it's obviously rude. We'll just have to wait and see with respect to that. Alan Stevens will be joining us. Beverly, what sort of week have you had?
It's good so far. It's
good
only,
so far.
It's only Thursday, right?
Yeah, by the time you get Thursday, you're into the sort of final line of things. I mean, it's just a case of you start off with this and then you carry on. That's the important thing. Just keep on carrying on.
Yeah, it's been great.
And in your dancing expertise, because you've danced all over the world and you're the examining body for dance, etc., have you ever encountered many magicians?
Loads.
Yeah, loads. So, it's a tough question, this, and obviously he's in the studio. How do you think David compares with
Well, you see, yeah? I haven't seen him on stage with his costume, what music he uses, and the whole shebang.
With
the
rabbit.
Mm-hmm. So I just watched him do some hand tricks before I've even had toast, so it was very, very tricky for me
and
to
And hand tricks before toast can be very traumatic at the best of times, so just work our way through that. Well, anyway, in terms of advice, you are the sole person in this studio who can provide Eleanor with advice because she is doing the Introduction to Journalism Studies thing that you took last year with me. So gearing up for all of those things like presentations, etc. So you got a chance to really sort of say, don't do that, do that, don't do this, etc. and such like stuff. Yeah, so it's
on to you. In the presentation, just imagine you've never met the people before and introduce yourself and say your name. That's where we all went wrong last year. And
all go wrong. It's just a minor sort of thing. Setting the scene.
For the essay, just don't go over the word count.
Okay, yeah. Oh, no.
It's so easy. There's so much
info. Don't waffle, don't waffle.
It's all there. When you're the daughter of a diplomat, clearly etiquette and consideration of others is going to be instilled at you from a young age. When you've attended a private country school and also worked with members of the royal family, studied human science at Oxford University, clearly you're the ideal person. And with a master's degree in social psychology and performance theory, it can only be the truly talented, amazingly wonderful Catherine Lewis. How are you, Catherine?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Good. Well, clearly, from the point of view of netiquette, we've shared this with our team of five co-hosts in the studio. I think they're a little bit uncertain about this response, but you've got some very firm views when it comes to replying to messages, using message, etc., and not simply saying, oh, I'll leave it for about 4 or 5 days.
We do. Digital etiquette is this whole new thing that has occurred. You know, I work with the Brits and we've been making guides for things like letter writing for about 250 years. And suddenly we're making guides on how to communicate with good manners on things like Messenger. And now this has all come about because Messenger from Facebook did a big research review and found that on Valentine's Day, which is tomorrow, there's a 20% surge of how much people are messaging each other, which is great, but also, as we found out, a minefield.
Yeah, for all sorts of reasons, which I won't go into at this particular stage. But what actually constitutes good digital etiquette? I mean, we've got a range of generations in the studio. We've got Beverly, we've got David, we've got from America and North Carolina, we've got clearly Jessica, and we've got from Norwich, I know, amazing. Eleanor is with us, and indeed from Lincoln, so heaven only knows. Emma Street is with us as well. So, I mean, I think, do we all use text? Do we all use messages?
Yeah.
Do that, etc. So what are the do's and don'ts? So we'll just see, Catherine, how sort of this chimes, really.
Well, the do's and don'ts, one big thing was actually the proper use of English, which we weren't expecting. Everyone thinks it's a much more sort of casual way, Messenger, but actually about 40% of the people we asked were offended if people did abbreviations or they didn't put proper grammar. Now, my mum's an English teacher, so it's something on our family group chat I get in so much trouble, but it turns out the rest of the UK found the same thing. So that's the first thing, is actually use the right language. But be clear, it is a conversation, but it's not face-to-face. So sarcasm can go wrong, jokes can go wrong, be simple.
Now, clearly, bringing in our American correspondent, officially designated as such, that would be, of course, yourself, Jessica. I see that, Catherine, you are the authority on British manners when it comes to the Today Show, well, not just the Today Show, but also NBC, from that point of view. What about American English? And you know, that, is that something we just think, is it all down to those American correcting spellings?
Well, there are a lot of differences. We find that sort of in America, sometimes people tend to be more casual and sort of more informal with their conversations. So one thing we always say is know your audience, especially if it's a group chat. Know who's in that group chat and sort of, you know, revise accordingly. For example, like my mother, she's 75, she loves a message, but she will not believe me that fruit and vegetables might have emojis, might have ulterior meanings, and she still thinks that that crying, laughing face is just crying. And so when my brother's cat died, she sent this whole ream of this crying, laughing emoji, thinking she was actually being compassionate.
Yeah, there you have it, you see, the challenge of a visual imagery. And so, I mean, it's almost as though we're going back to the days of, well, let's just go back to orality, you know. That's
oh, there we go.
Yeah, exactly. Any questions from yourself, Jessica, that you'd like to sort of throw in at this stage?
I guess with the formality differences between the US and...
when your mum's listening to this, and it's now, what, nearly 20 to 4 in the morning in North Carolina. So.
I guess I was curious, is that like a generational thing as well? Even within Great Britain, is it older generations tend to be more formal when they're messaging and younger ones are more casual, or?
We thought actually that the older generations would want more formality, but the things that really bugged sort of the youngers and millennials was people who didn't sort of sign off in style or who left you hanging, you know, who's read a message and then that was a big thing. And ghosting. Ghosting is probably something that younger generation, it means a lot more too. Ghosting is when you stop all communication with someone you're dating. And we did find that actually over sort of the age of 45, people are much more likely to be polite about leaving a conversation.
Hmm. Well, Emma.
Yeah. I'm just having a bit of a giggle.
Yeah. Any thoughts?
I was just thinking about my great uncle and aunt. Whenever they post on Facebook messages to me, they put lol because they think it means lots of love.
Yeah.
So they'll, you know, put some kind of message and then put lol. Yeah. Uncle
that
Ryan.
That came up a lot, actually. People not quite understanding that. So be really clear. I mean, it is interesting how, you know, it's great that there's a surge of sort of people messaging on Valentine's Day, but would you rather get a card, or if you can't have a card, you know, what do you feel about that?
I'd like a card. I think I would like a card.
Eleanor, thoughts from yourself?
I'm the least romantic person ever.
Good
so, you know, someone would send me a card and I'd be like, thank you. I'll put that to one side. So, yeah, for me, it's probably a message would do.
And David, I mean, are we listening to this thinking it's like a whole new world?
Well, it's interesting. I think with text messaging and messaging and so
quite,
on.
You're quite social in your media sort of likes and dislikes various other bits and pieces. You're constantly sort of reselling. I mean, I'm very impressed.
Well, I think that if you know someone very well, texting and messaging is fine. But
until you ghost them, in which case.
Well, if you don't want to do it. But if it's someone you don't know, so maybe in business, I always try and get them on the phone and chat to them face to face. And then I think that with texting and messaging, because it could be quite easy to misconstrue someone's message if you don't know them well, and you don't, as Emma was saying about LOL there, with our great uncle, that's the thing that quite often it might be. easy to miscommunicate something.
I mean, Beverly, ever any challenges with your son on this one? Where you think, what the hell have you sent me? Or what have I sent him?
I mean, he does abbreviate. He's 19, and I get TBH, like, to be honest, or IDK, I don't know. And he sends
IRL
all
in real life?
These, yeah.
IMO.
And sometimes I ask him, I say, what?
Yeah, what?
And then he sends back the full version. I say, why don't you just put the full version?
Well, we've produced this guide of D's and Dates, but we're thinking we need to sort of work with Meta now to produce a sort of maybe a sort of dictionary as well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Catherine, share with us, how can people find that new etiquette guide for online messaging?
Yeah, if you go to the website messengernews.fb.com, you'll find a link to it. You know, you can download it. You can even give it to someone as a gift on Valentine's Day.
Wow. Well, I do know, Catherine, you'll be flooded with e-messages, e-cards and various other bits and pieces with poundings of all sorts of other bits and pieces. But have you actually had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on this traditional mechanism of communication, the radio, today? Has it worked for you?
It has, I have to say. I love a phone call as well. Wow. We mustn't forget we can use our phones for phone calls.
It's amazing. That technology Alexander Graham Bell put into place. Will you be kind enough to return then, Catherine? Will you come back?
Absolutely.
Yay.
So far, we've gone from Gibraltar and Gabriella Peralta through Richard Fitzwilliam's views on the Academy Awards, Parasite and the Gentleman, through World Radio Day with Dr. Becky Spellman. Yay! Katie Ford talked about her challenges between mums and daughters and her novel Springtime Affair. And, of course, we had Mark Cuthbert talking about National Geographic Ordnance Survey maps changing the shape of the nation. We followed that through with Guide Dog Challenges with Helen Huntsvent. And then Catherine Lewis from Debrett's. We've just finished Words Don't Come Easy, but certainly they do if you're CaldorCity.com's finest Doctor Who scholar Alan Stevens, don't they, Alan?
Hello, how are you?
We're okay. I think the rest of the team are kind of just about limping through. No, it's all good. They're all fine. They're like greyhounds today. It's been fantastic. You know, Beverly and Emma, they've been firing on all cylinders. It's been Eleanor's first show. How have you been finding it, Eleanor?
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I was a bit nervous coming on originally, and now I'm
exposure therapy working.
Yeah, it is.
And your first morning show on a Thursday, of course. Yes. Do you follow Doctor Who? I mean, we've introduced you over the years to Star Trek over the last couple of weeks, etc.
I do watch Doctor Who. My brother is a huge fan. again.
There we are. You see the words of North Carolina's finest there, Jessica Burtis. Huge. Has he been following the current series with Jodie Whittaker?
I don't believe so. I think he hasn't followed the current one, but I know he and my mom used to binge watch Doctor Who.
In which case, when you've got a scholar like Alan Stevens online to share with us the whole thing, Alan, would you like to share with us the views on the last two episodes? Is it getting better? Is it worth Jessica's brother and family tuning in to the Doctor in North Carolina?
not really, no, not moment.
Okay. Tough call. I mean, Ellen, are you a Who fan at all?
My dad actually runs a comic convention back in Norwich, so I've met a lot of the previous Doctor Whos.
Oh, my God, that's
cool. Like, this year we just had Peter Davison and Sylvester McCoy, yeah. So that was amazing. So for me, I've had a bit of a gauge in that, but I haven't been watching it recently, no. I kind of petered off after Matt Smith.
And David, so busy doing the magic yourself, really.
Well, big, massive fan of Doctor Who. Grew up with Doctor Who. Mentioned Peter Davidson there, who's certainly a big favourite of mine when I was growing up.
It's
Sylvester McCoy. We talked about him last time I was on, Alex, yes.
He's the loveliest person.
Is he? Still going strong. He's doing well.
And Emma, as we've been told, is also quite a keen follower of Doctor Who and has been watching the series avidly. So what are your thoughts on the current series?
I didn't see the last one because I didn't have a TV licence because I was moving house. So, you know.
Yeah, very good.
Got to stay safe and legal.
Keeping it legal, yes.
But I watched not the last one, the one before, and yeah, I haven't got amazing things to say about it.
Not amazing things to say about it, Alan.
I'm a massive fan about it, really.
Oh. I can't even remember what the title was. What was the title?
Don't get me started on titles and such. So that's what the internet is for. You know, you're a specialist. Talk us through. I actually quite like the recent episode. I thought they were actually making some attempts to just be quite interesting. Anyway, take it away, Alan. You've got 5 minutes to share.
Oh, you've got to tell me. What was the title of last week's episode?
Okay, we're looking.
Oh, I know. It was Praxis, wasn't it?
Praxis.
It was Praxis. About PRX. Yeah, it was about this.
That's not public relations axis, by the way. It's Praxis.
It was about the idea that we're all got microplastics in them, and an alien virus or pathogen came down from outer space, and affected this plastic and made these sort of rather horrible. Grey things appear on us, and then we exploded. So,
People had similar effects doing some of the practical sort of work on the journalism course. So just don't go there, you know.
And on a positive side, the sort of illness they got was, quite effective. You know, it looked quite good. And there was at one point these birds attacked the doctor and her companions. And there was a scene when the flapping of all these birds sort of brought the sand up next to the TARDIS. So I thought it was a very, very good effect indeed. But as for the story, I don't think it really, like a lot of Chibnall episodes or Chibnall showrunner episodes, didn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, it didn't seem to really hold together as a proper story. And it had a kind of environment message, which again... was a bit obscured by the fact that, you know, the pivotal element was an alien virus. And then this week's episode, which is called Can You Hear Me, was a bit more interesting in that there was a very nice cartoon bit at one point, wasn't there? Animation section. And the music, I thought, was excellent. But again, it was a story that, about halfway through, I thought, this is really good. And then suddenly it died, and there was a whole scene with Yaz and some lesbian police officer or something. And I
she may not have been. They didn't actually signpost it as much as they have.
I don't know.
It
seemed a bit dodgy to me.
All right.
It was apparently about mental illness, but I don't know. I mean, I wasn't sure if the end thing, because it said, you know, anyone who's suffering from mental illness could phone this number. I wasn't sure if it was, you know, this episode had induced mental illness and they were concerned about the audience, or whether there was some theme there which was so opaque that I just didn't notice it.
Harsh, but possibly fair. I mean, Emma, does that trigger off sort of things saying, well...
I do think that they're trying quite hard to have some kind of deeper message in them, and I'm watching some of the old Doctor Whos, and, you know, it's just about some alien or some kind of monsters, and it's just a whole lot of fun, and, you know, trying to save some planet or stop some invasion happening, you know, and now it's a lot more kind of, oh, you know, deeper message about plastics, or we've got, you know, you've really got to think about the earth and all this sort of stuff. And my dad watched one of the episodes with me, and he was like, I've never had Doctor Who preaching at me before. He's like, I'm not sure what I think about this.
Well, actually, that isn't, when you say old Doctor, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. I mean, if you go back to the Pertwee era, there was various stories about environmental issues. There's one story called The Green Death about this company that pumped toxic waste into a disused mine, and there was a number of environmental stories, but also stories about imperialism and stuff. So, you know, there have been message stories before. In fact, I did one Doctor Who story called Persepolis, which was about the entering the common market. They did do that, but this is done in a fairly crass and I'd say not particularly well thought out way. What was the previous message? What about how apparently in the future that you know, if the environment degenerates, we're all going to turn into huge eight foot tall savage monsters?
I think you might find it was done a few years ago by Primeval, actually, but that's another line entirely.
That was a terrible show. That was
doesn't stop it being an inspiration for Chris Chibnall. So not great. Okay, Mark's
out of 10. Yeah, unfortunately, probably was an inspiration for Chris Chibnall.
Mark's out of 10 for Praxis.
Well, a bird attack was quite good, so probably 3.
3 out of 10. And for Can You Hear Me? Which, of course, is the episode with Siri and Sheffield.
That's the first Doctor Who story in over 50 years, ever. So there's been over 50 seasons. There's been Doctor Who starting in 63, and then we're now in 2000. And work it out. I'm not very good at maths. Like 57 years, is it? First Doctor Who episode ever.
Yes.
To have a question mark at the end of it.
Exactly. Quite literally.
So that's worth 1 point, isn't it?
Exactly.
And then there was the animation. That was nice.
Okay.
And then there was the music. That was nice. That's 3.
Yeah.
And then I quite like the black girl. That's 4. And I quite like the effects and the idea of someone being trapped between a planet.
Okay.
That's 5
out of 10. There we are. So 3 out of 10, 5 out of 10. It's not going to get the North Carolina audience really gagging to listen or indeed view the whole thing. But
it's bizarre because the advert for the next episode is the advert for the next episode is effectively is saying, you know, his caption comes up saying the last two episodes are really good, which is a bit of an odd way to advertise the next episode, isn't it? It's like saying, well, you know, the two episodes after this one are really good.
You've got
the Cyberman in.
The Haunting of Villa Diodati and Ascension of the Cyberman. And that's it for another year.
No, there's 3. There's 3 episodes.
Well, yeah, double that up. Okay, let us move
on. Listen, there's the Timeless Child, which is the last one.
Yes.
It's Ascension of the Cyberman, which is not an easy word to say. A bit like
Judgment of the
Dune. And then there's this Haunting of, I don't know, Villa Rest or whatever it was.
Well, never mind. As long as we've sent the text appropriately, all will be well. Alan, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
Sorry, it was so quick, I didn't get it.
I know. Have you enjoyed the last few moments on the programme, Alan
Stevens? The last few moments? No, an argument with you over your... Yes, it's fine.
Nice
to meet everybody. Hello.
Exactly.
Goodbye.
It's so much to pack in. Oh, I don't know, as the Black Eyed Peas might say grammatically with a question mark, where is the love? Take care, Alan. Speak soon.
Bye-bye.
The whole world addicted to the drama, only attracted to things that'll bring the trauma. Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA, the big CIA, the Bloods and the Crips and the KKK. But if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate, and to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate, and that's exactly how anger works and operates. Man, you gotta have love just to set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love, y'all.
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach and would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us, send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning.
Change. New days are strange. Is the world insane? If love and peace are so strong, why are the pieces of love that don't belong? Nations dropping bombs,
chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing suffering. As the youth are young, so ask yourself, is the loving really gone? So I could ask myself, really, what is going wrong in this world that we living in? People keep on giving in, making wrong decisions, only visions of them dividends, not respecting each other, denying thy brother. A war's going on, but the reason's undercover. The truth is kept secret, it's swept under the rug. If you never know truth, then you never know love. What's the love, y'all? Come on.
I don't know, maybe it's in the White House somewhere. Okay, the Black Eyed Peas, Where Is the Love, wrapping us up for the programme today. Thanks in the studio to David Fox. Yay, David! Your role hasn't finished. Which one of our team today are you going to award the contributor of the show piece to today? Who's going to get it?
Well, I brought a little pop.
Is it going to be Emma? Is it going to be Jessica? Is it going to be Beverly? Is it going to be Eleanor? Who are you going
to
go for?
Well, to give a bit of background, yes. I brought the chocolates and to thank you for coming to see me at Carriages. So it was lovely to see you all. Yeah. It's a tough one, but I think it has to go to Eleanor. I tell you why, because it's Eleanor's first show today. And Eleanor hasn't appeared nervous at all. She's done exceptionally well. I think she deserves a round of applause for that, actually. Yes, very well.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Next time I'll bring a bigger box of chocolates so everybody can have one. Yes.
It's just joy upon joy. Thank you, dear listener, for being with us. Have a great Valentine's Day, whatever you're doing. Remember, it's a decent massacre with Al Capone. And let us move on for all sorts of other bits and pieces. We'll be back with Midweek Drive next week. Emma, thank you. Emma Street.
Thank you.
Thank you, David Fox.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Beverly Spencer. And thank you, Jessica Burtis. And Jessica's mum, of course. She's still awake.
Yeah, hi, mum. Go to bed.
Exactly. And thank you, Eleanor. That's
thank
it.
You.
We're out of here. Can we all say happy Valentine's Day? One, two, three.
Happy Valentine's Day.
It's no wonder why sometimes I'm feeling under. Gotta keep my faith alive. Love is found. Ask yourself.
Where is the love? Where is the love? Where is the love? One world, one world. We only got one world, one world. That's all we got. One world, one world. It's
so FM.
FM.
Online.
Online.
Mobile.
Mobile.
This is.
This is.